forward. The BBC says Craig Wright told the news organization he's the man known as Satoshi Nakamoto. Wright is a computer scientist, inventor, and academic. He says he launched the digital currency with help from other people. He decided to come forward to stop the spread of what he called misinformation about bitcoins. This is USA Radio News. Breaking news online at usaradio.com.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County. The weather today is a slight chance of showers, mostly cloudy with a high near 63, south winds around 6 miles an hour, and a chance of precipitation is 20%. Tonight, showers, mainly after midnight, calm winds becoming northeast around 6 miles an hour after midnight, and there's an 80% chance of precipitation. Tuesday, showers, high near 62, northeast winds around 7 miles an hour, 80% chance of precipitation, I can speak. Tuesday night, guess what, a chance of showers, mostly cloudy with a low around 49, there'll be a light variable wind, and Wednesday, chance of showers, but the sun may come out. With a high near 65, there'll be a light and variable wind, and it's about a 40% chance of precipitation. Wednesday night, guess what? A chance of showers. I'm not going to go through Thursday through the rest because Thursday's a chance of showers, Friday's a chance of showers, and Saturday's a chance of showers. So you have a good chance of showers, and the temperatures will range from 63 to 65 to around 67. And hopefully one day, before next week, you'll have the sun will come out. Welcome to Mental Health Matters. I'm your host, Larry Cartwright, and this is NAMI's Hour, compliments of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and there is a chapter of NAMI in every county in the state of New Jersey, every state in the union, and overseas. In Hunterdon County, we're all volunteers. We have no paid staff, no office. We work out of our houses. And someone once told me, if you work out of your house, the commute is great from the kitchen to the living room. So I guess that's pretty good. What we do is we try to help people who have either someone in their family or know of someone, it doesn't have to be blood, who has a mental health issue. The way we do that is we are, well, in fact, my wife and I are currently teaching. This Thursday will be the last week, the 12th week of a 12-week course called Family to Family, which we try to enlighten people who are caregivers to someone who has a mental illness, and whether it's their son or daughter or somebody they work with or next door neighbor or whatever. And we try to let them understand more what it's like to have the mental illness and what those people are going through. And we, you know, have crisis situations, what to do, what not to do. We talk about medications, side effects, what to say in certain situations, what not to say. We also have a support group, which meets monthly, and that's for anybody who wants to come. There's no registration or anything. You just show up. It's at 52 East Main Street, and, you know, and everything is private. And you might have somebody that is going through the same thing you are, or somebody that has gone through it and can also offer some advice to you. We also have, in this case, economy. A lot of times, both people work, the husband and wife, just to make ends meet. So consequently, the teachers are ones who spend a lot of time during the week with the children, the younger children, and, you know, young teenagers. And we have a thing called Educating the Educators, which we try to teach the teachers what to look for in, you know, something in a child that maybe stands out as maybe they should, you know, address a little more and notify the parents of. We have, we are working with the county prosecutor for jail diversion, and which we'd rather see people with a mental health issue who have a minor offense against them rather divert from jail rather than to be in jail. Anyway, we are very fortunate today to have with us two gentlemen. Lawrence Brooks is the executive director of Hunterdon Youth Services, and I know I'm going to murder your name, but I'm going to try it anyway. And we have Levent Bayrothley. Oh, okay. I said it. Not too bad either, I guess. And he is a new board member, and he's now the secretary of the board. And Levent is a financial advisor and managing director of the White Oak Financial Group. Welcome, gentlemen. I really appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And I always ask everybody that comes on, it's just out of curiosity because, you know, I ask people how you got in this type of work. And some people will say, well, I had two kids and needed a job and a mortgage payment, you know, so, and this came along. And other people say, well, I wanted to do it for a while or whatever. I wanted to help people. So, Lawrence, how did you get in this line of work?
Well, I say that it had to be a genetic component that I got into this line of work. My father was a minister, and then my mother was a social worker. Okay. So I guess in some ways it sort of is the family business. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me, and particularly with my work with Hunterdon Youth Services, is, you know, I knew obviously a lot about my father's life story. But after he died and we found some of his old journals and things, one of the things that we understood more deeply than we had while he was alive was the fact that he had been sent to an orphanage when he was three because his mother had died and he was the youngest child. And his family was basically a sharecropper farming family in the South, and there just weren't enough resources for the family to take care of him. Right. And to read some of what he wrote about what it was like for him in those experiences, it gives me such, I guess, compassion for what so many of our kids go through. And, you know, he was able to overcome all those obstacles and, you know, from my perspective anyway, have a pretty miraculous life.
Right.
So, you know, I feel like that's part of what I want to give back to our kids as well.
Sure.
Because so often they feel isolated and alone in what they're going through.
Levent?
Well, I became aware of the Hunterdon Youth Services a few years ago through a friend. And once I had been introduced to the organization and got an understanding of it. And it was also during a part of my life where I wanted to give back to the community and get involved and make a difference. I'm a very firm believer that it's it takes a community, it takes a village to raise a child. And, you know, we as a community, and I speak holistically on that matter about all of us, we are in this together. And if we all want, you know, a good future, we have to invest time, we have to invest resources to build. And the Hunterdon Youth Services is providing an absolutely fantastic environment for children that really need support. And I do think we make a big difference in a lot of people's lives. And it touches the children, it touches their families. It's fantastic. And I find myself, I find very fulfilled in providing my time and resources to help Hunterdon Youth Services and other organizations of similar.
Yeah, it's. I know what you're saying. Aside from this radio show and doing the one after this with the hospital because they conned me into doing it because I used to work there after I retired. I worked one day a week at the hospital on a Saturday in emergency services. So if somebody came in like OD'd or attempted suicide, I would talk to the families and tell them what's available and stuff. So they, you know, Kathleen, who runs it, the PR type thing, she says, well, you know everybody here. They know you, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay, you know, so anyway.
It helps to be connected, Larry.
Yeah, exactly. But and then with NAMI, you know, I've been involved with NAMI for many years. as you know, my youngest son is, we have four children, and my youngest son is schizophrenic. And, you know, so we've been doing that, and we've been teaching the classes and running support groups, and I give presentations, and we do a monthly presentation to educational services. We've gave a presentation just recently down to the Princeton Seminary, the Episcopal Seminary in Princeton, or Presbyterian. It was Presbyterian. And it was, you know, very interesting. So I know what you're saying. You know, you have to give, and I work harder now that I'm retired than when I worked, because when I worked, I was a boss. So you do that, and you do that, and let me know what happens on Friday, you know. But now it's nobody to go that to. And I look at my wife, and she laughs, and, you know, so. But for those who are listening who are not familiar with the Hunter and Hughes Services, you want to give us a quick overview of what it is and what you do?
Sure. So Hunterton Youth Services actually has a pretty rich history. It started in the late 70s, and originally it started out as a shelter. And it was a shelter that was designed specifically to serve kids here in Hunterdon County, both boys and girls. Mm-hmm. At that time, I think every county in the state of New Jersey was required to have a shelter for services for kids. So over a period of time, things evolved, and the system of care, as we call it, changed. And the board and staff had the vision to recognize that perhaps the next level of service that was really needed for children was more of a group home environment. Okay. So probably about 15 plus years ago, they made the decision to change the model into a group home. Right now, we focus on adolescent males. It can be as young as age 13, as old as 19, even sometimes 20, depending upon what their individual situations are. But I think one of the things that I don't think people realize about us at Hunterton Youth Services is that we can take young men from anywhere in the state. Right. So we do serve, obviously, Hunterton County youth, mm-hmm. But we can serve youth and families from anywhere in the state of New Jersey.
Is this the only one in the state of New Jersey?
It's the only one that our organization operates, but but there are other, obviously, group homes that other providers
have. Yeah, obviously, but yes. Yours is, this is the
this
one.
This is it.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And over the years, you now just deal with males, is that
That's
correct?
That's right. Okay. That's right.
Okay. Is there anything in the future for females? I mean, like, you know, to do something for females?
Well, I guess what I would say is our board is always having conversation about what else should we be doing and how does that fit in with our mission. So I think that it's something that is considered. But I also think that one of the things that our board is very conscious of is that, you know, so we're doing the residential aspect, and what are some of the other aspects that we could engage in that might include females, but that would expand our continuum of care rather than just replicating what we already do. And I think that, you know, and I know you've probably had this experience through some of the work that you've done with NAMI as well, you know, residential programming is some of the most intensive services that you can provide. So I think our board really looks at, you know, they haven't ruled out additional residential services, but they also want to see what else is available and how else we can serve the community in different aspects as well.
See, I only look at it as that it's not only males who have the problems that you address, but females have the same problems, you know. And so it's just, you know, my own thought. It's, you know, not having sat on your board or, you know, or anything. But you know what I'm saying? It's just like if you're saying, well, males have this problems and, you know, we're trying to help them. Well, females have the same problems, and sometimes it's harder to help them because they're females, you know.
And I do think there are some gender differences in providing those services, but I also think that, you know, with the males in particular, sometimes it's harder to get males, teenage males, into foster homes and other kinds of less restrictive environments, because unfortunately society still has sort of a stereotype that teenage males are difficult to deal with. And since all of us were teenage males at one point, we can say that's probably true. But, you know, unfortunately, yeah. I think that the perception out there with other resources that are available for females, sometimes it's easier for them to get into some of those services than it is for males.
Okay. Yeah. Levent, your partner there, Lawrence, has told me that one of the things he believes that you brought to the service and to the board is an added layer of sophistication and accountability. Have you done that? And why do you think it's essential for nonprofits to have that?
Well, I appreciate the kind opinion, and I guess it was the way I was raised. My parents, my mother in particular, taught me a lesson a long time ago, which was when you point your finger at somebody else, there's at least three of them pointing back at yourself. And over my life, I've matured and begun to think all pretty much exclusively about solutions and not the problems. All right, I think our society too much wants to harp on what went wrong and this and that versus, well, how are we going to make it better? Now, to that end, I've taken a certain accountability in my own life. I endeavor never to point that finger, but to figure out how to make things better. Quite frankly, I am slightly an anal person, and I guess that has led to my avocation. I've always been had a high aptitude when it comes to numbers and math. It led me to a financial services field, and in turn, and since I've been doing it for so long, I think we all understand that being in the financial service industry, your integrity and your accountability is held to a higher standard. And I just, when I came to Hunter and Youth Services, I made a few things very clear, which is what I'm here to help the organization and use my life skills and professional skills to better the organization in any way I can. So, yes, I try to insist on every T being crossed and every I dotted, and that as I continue to evolve as a human being and expose myself to as much as I can, there's too much, in my opinion, which I think anything more than 1% is too much, but too much malfeasance and activities going on in organizations that are just reprehensible. And I've being on the board, just always wanted to share with the board of, let's look at the big picture of this. If we were sitting outside of the board, is not how would it look? Right. And again, let's always put our best foot forward and do things that we know are the best for our residents, the community, in whole. And if we do that, we're never going to have a bad light shown on us.
Right. So you remind me of a very good friend of mine who is bipolar, has been for the biggest part of his life. And he's a chief financial officer, and a number of large organizations. And he says the same thing, you know, maybe different words or whatever, but it's exactly the same meaning. You know, you got to cross the T, you know, dot the I's, cross the T's, and, you know, and he's on the board of NAMI. So if I say something, he'll go, Larry, we can't do that because, you know, and he'd read off a list of why not, you know. And all I want to do is get something done, and it's like, oh, we can't do this. So, yeah, but we're best of friends. So, but I understand perfectly what you're saying because – and, you know, I think boards need people like that. They really do.
We need the balance. And you know, one of the things that Levent often says to us is, you know, so, yes, what we're doing right now is fine, and there's nothing wrong with it. But 100 years from now, when none of us are here and somebody's going through these records and thinking about why were they doing it this way – would we be happy with what they might perceive?
Right.
And
exactly.
And I think that's really helped to give us a different logic in how we approach things.
Sure, sure.
And with any organization, whether you're a nonprofit or for-profit or whatever, if you're not continuing to grow and evolve, then you're becoming stagnant and stale or even
absolutely.
Regressing.
Absolutely. So, yeah. No, I agree. You know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm not that type of person. I'm just get it done, you know.
That's right. But I'm with you, Larry.
I need somebody like you to, you know, say, this is what you're supposed to do, you know.
Well, to that end, Larry, the board and Hunting Youth Services within the last about 4 years or so, it went through a little bit of an evolutionary time. We have a new executive director. We have new board members, myself included. The topic of giving or supporting the female population has come up many a time. we have finite resources.
Mm-hmm.
We would love to change that tomorrow. So everybody listening, keep listening. we'll make sure to get in how you out, everybody can get involved.
Oh, yeah.
So
we will touch on that.
Yeah, we are absolutely. That is not a no, but it's at this current time. This is the situation, and this is what we can do.
Right.
We would love to do more. We would love to help as many as we possibly could.
Well, that's one of the reasons that we're in the process of selling the houses. We just don't have the people. You know, we have members who join, but they're either going through their own crisis, you know, at the time, and they don't have the time to donate, which I understand because I remember the crisis we went through, and it was not just 2 days. It went on for about almost 10 years.
Right.
And so I understand. It's just that those of us who are maybe not as young as we once were, and like next week we're going to South Carolina, you know, and it's just friends of ours said, hey, come on. Okay, go ahead. When do you want to go? Oh, next week. Okay, great. You know, and, you know, we don't have anybody that can say, okay, well, we'll fill in while you're gone to take, you know, care of this or that or the other. So thank goodness they're both, the houses are now empty. So there's no, you know, the tenants all have relocated. So it's just good. How does someone who maybe needs your services or is in want of your services, how do they go get it?
So that's a very good question. And I guess one of the things, just to add some clarity to that, is about half of our kids are kids who come out of what we think of as traditional foster care.
Okay.
So half of them would be the kids who have been abused, abandoned, or neglected. Those kids tend to have very, very limited communication with their biological families. And then the other half of our kids are community kids. So they could be your kids or my kids or Levin's kids, where, you know, we would still have custody of them, but maybe their behavioral issues are just beyond what we can manage in our own home. So in the state of New Jersey, they have case management organizations that are assigned to each county, and the case management organization has to make the referral to our organization.
Okay.
And generally speaking, with the case management organization, they're going to do an assessment of what's going on with your child and the family and make a determination of, you know, can we provide mm-hmm. services in the home mm-hmm. rather than sending them right. to a group home? Or maybe a group home isn't enough. Maybe they need to go to a treatment facility first and then step down to a group home and then back to your home.
When you're saying treatment facility, you're talking about a mental health treatment or physical treatment or alcohol, drug?
Could be any of the above, depending upon what the individual situation is. But, you know, when we think about a continuum of care for kids, the residential would be what we would consider sort of a deeper end. So for kids who have a higher level of need than what we could manage in a group home, because, you know, in our group home environment, it is community-based. Kids are going to public school. Kids are hopefully having employment in the community.
Mm-hmm.
They're engaging with the community. Whereas in a residential program, most of those things are conducted in-house. And generally speaking, a more secured or locked environment. And that doesn't mean that they're criminal kids. It just means that for their own safety and well-being, until their behaviors can be brought to a level that is acceptable in the community, that's the kind of environment that they need.
Okay.
So, but anyway, to answer your question, it is the case management organizations that do all of the referrals. But again, I think one of the things that's great about us here in the state of New Jersey is it doesn't mean that your child has to be in the foster care system to receive that help.
Right.
It can be a child that is
with his
a
parents.
Member of the community.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Do you find that there's some of your clients or children or whatever you want to, you know, they're not children, actually. They're young adults.
Well, I still call them kids, too, Larry. Yeah, I get in trouble for that all the time. They hate it.
So
hopefully none
kids.
Of them are listening.
My youngest kid is 39, you know, so I mean,
he'll
always
be the baby, right?
They're kids.
He'll be the baby.
He'll always be the baby, right, exactly. And he's the baby to his other two brothers
That's
and
right.
sisters, too.
That's
you know?
Right.
So, but do you find that some of your clients that you have, along with maybe, you know, abuse or broken home or whatever, have mental health problems?
We do. Quite a few, if not all of them, have some sort of mental health issue. And, you know, it probably ranges on the continuum.
Mm-hmm.
in terms of what their needs are. I would say that one of the things we're starting to see more and more of is more of personality disorder types of diagnoses.
Right.
It used to be that it was much more like oppositional defiant and conduct disorder and those kinds of things. The other thing that we're seeing quite a bit of is kids who have some degree of autism. So we don't go too far into the autism spectrum, but somebody who's on the lower end, we can provide services to. And we've had almost as many as a third of our population at any point in time who have some degree of autism. But a lot of our kids do have psychiatric diagnoses that we're working with them and their families to address. And certainly I know it's very parallel to the work that you guys do in terms of trying to educate both the resident themselves as well as the family and talk about, you know, what's the plan of how you deal with this now and into the future in a way that allows you to be successful.
Right. Do it doesn't prevent a client or a child or kid, whatever, to become a part of your program because he has a mental health issue, does it?
Not normally. I mean, some of it is based on
How severe it is,
yes.
Right. Well, that would make sense.
You know, because if the way they're expressing that mental illness is in such an extreme that we don't feel like we can ensure their safety or the safety of other kids in the program, then obviously we can't bring them into our program.
Right.
And again, that's part of where those residential
programs come into play,
and that's where they would go first, and then once they're ready to be stepped down, then we could consider them for our kind of program.
Okay.
But, you know, again, with most of our kids, we really try. See, I just call them kids. So with most of our residents, we really try to do a combination.
When you're at my age, they're kids.
we try to do a combination of, you know, like psychotropic medication management along with traditional counseling. And, you know, one of the things that I think has been frustrating for all of us in this field is, you know, just that historically there hasn't been a lot of research that really talks about, you know, what are the best approaches and what are best practices. And I think we are all starting to become better educated about, you know, in our case, we're really looking more at trauma-informed care and the fact that all of our kids have gone through trauma.
Right.
And then how do you respond to them differently because of that? And the way that you would think of a normal 15 or 16-year-old and the way they would process information is very different from somebody who has experienced ongoing and continuous trauma. And then what does that mean to our staff in terms of how we engage these kids and help them to learn a different way of being?
Do you find that you get some of the kids who are sexually abused from, you know, either parents or foster parents or what have you?
Yes. There's quite a bit of sexual abuse that has taken place, as well as physical abuse and obviously emotional abuse too.
Well, yeah.
But the sexual abuse, yes, we see quite a bit of that.
It just drives me insane, you know?
Yes.
But I understand. Maybe Levent could answer. I'm not sure. You're on the board. So I understand that there's some federal legislation pending that could significantly affect your programs.
Yes.
You want to tell us what's behind it and how you're preparing to respond to it?
Yeah, I can definitely give you a little bit of an overview, but it certainly warrants a little more seasons with that. It's interesting.
Yeah, but you're the professional guy. We know what the...
Well, it's interesting.
I'm only teasing,
yeah,
but, you know.
Earlier, I made this motion how it takes a village. And one thing I've done in my life lately in the last few years is I've asked people to, every time you want to say the government, insert we the people. So don't say the government did this or the government did that. I said we the people decided. We the people are going to do this because we are all in this together. To that end, there is a lot of debate going on in this environment around what is best for children and whether or not congregate care, which is basically what we provide, is the solution. There are some out there that believe moving children out of congregate care, or more specifically back to their homes or to foster care, is the better way to go. It has not been decided. It's still pending. We are, from my estimation on the board, and I want to make it just to be clear, I always view myself as my obligation is to better the organization from a administrative standpoint. I don't, right. I lend my time for the kids when they need it to do this, to do that, but I don't provide any sort of care in that traditional sense. I actually have always believed I needed to keep myself at somewhat arm's length to make big decisions that some kids will like and some kids, some of the residents will or not. And to that matter, the staff also. Ultimately, I could have a good decision where a staff member needs to be let go, or for that matter, we need to increase their responsibility.
Right.
So if you don't mind, that's not my specific area of need. I think I touched on it. All I would say is, a board member, we're aware of it. We've begun discussion around, well, how would we evolve as an organization? Because, again, I'm a volunteer also. All the board members are volunteers. Right. Our aim is to help kids have a better life.
And you know what bothers me, what you had said about there's a percentage of the quote-unquote people who want to see them go back into foster care. Well, you're putting them back to where they were. And, you know, it's just you read the paper and you listen to the news. There was, I think it was in Texas a couple days ago, they found these kids tied up in a backyard. Some were chained up in the cellar. I mean, and this is foster care, okay? And really? You know, I mean, it's like we don't investigate enough into the backgrounds of people who say they want to be foster parents or whatever. Some of them just do it for the money. And a lot of them just do it for the money. I'm not saying that there's not good people out there that with foster care, because there are. But I think that on a whole, we, everybody, has to look a little deeper before we say, oh, let's put a child who his own family is pretty much screwed up and put him into a foster home before we put him into a situation worse than what his own family was. You know, and...
Well, you know, I think that the majority of foster parents are wonderful, right?
Right.
And then you have the few rotten apples that spoil the bunch, right? But, you know, I think, you know, with the federal legislation that you and Levent were speaking on, you know, one of the things that I think is happening, and, you know, I think it happens anytime government gets involved, right? They're trying to do a one-size sort of fits all. And, you know, it's been interesting as we've begun to learn about this process, because one of the things that you realize, and I've obviously worked in other states besides New Jersey in this system, how different the states are in terms of what they provide. So one of the things I've heard is that there are states out there that, you know, here in New Jersey, we're fortunate that we have sort of a level system and, you know, we can somewhat base where you're going on your need.
Right.
Well, in other states, all they have is either in-home or out-of-home, and there's no, like, there's not a shelter, there's not a group home, there's not a residential. It's just, like, this one program, and that's it. So clearly that's not in the best interest of kids. And I think, you know, in an ideal world, I think our board has talked about it and we've talked about it, that, you know, yes, kids at home with families is, in the ideal world, where we would like kids to be,
sure.
Right?
In absolutely.
A loving, supportive family. What starts to make us nervous, or maybe I should say myself nervous, and then Levent can respond from the board, but is, you know, will the funding that's necessary to make all of those changes happen be there? And I think, you know, in the mental health arena, we saw some of that. You know, when we, you know, deinstitutionalization and getting people back into the community is wonderful, but are we going to be able to provide the resources to support people in the community? And I guess I feel like it's the same way as we think about making a shift with kids in care. You know, in theory, it sounds fantastic. But what is the how's the reality going to play out? And
sure.
How is the funding going to really be there to support those families and kids and provide the additional oversight necessary and all
right.
of those kinds of things?
And, you know, it's like it's so unfortunate because there's so many young people who need help, You know, obviously there's a whole hell of a lot that don't, but there's a lot that do. And, you know, to they want people who have come out of hospitals, state institutions or whatever, and they want him to get back into society. Okay? They want him to see their psychiatrist or their psychologist and to take their meds and to, you know, get their own place to live outside of a group home and, you know, one step at a time, get a job and get back into society. And when someone does that, then they lower their SSI, they raise their rent, and you're saying, well, you want them to be back in society. Now you're putting them, they're better off if they don't get a job, if they stay out of work. You know, it's just so frustrating. Because I know we faced that with my son, you know.
And we've experienced that with some of our kids as well. You know, if they earn over a certain amount or they have a certain amount in a savings account and they're not eligible for, you know, additional benefits. And
don't take more than $2,000 in your savings account.
Right.
And ever.
Right. And when you think about $2,000 in this day and age, you know, I mean, you know, 40 years ago, that felt like a lot of money. But
right.
$2,000 today is one month's rent or, you know.
Or pretty close.
So you know, it is frightening. And again, I think that as we look at it, you know, that's part of what our concern becomes is, you know, great in theory, very supportive of kids being at homes with supports and all of those kinds of things. But, you know, our fear becomes that the funding's not going to follow to meet the needs of the kids.
Right. And, you know, like I told you before, my son got a job and, you know, he's been there almost a year now. Yeah, April was a year. And, you know, he got his own apartment. He has, you know, Section 8 housing, which helps and stuff. But he's doing everything that so-called they want someone like him to do. So they raise his rent, $200. They lower his Social Security. I mean, come on, really? You know, like I said, you're better off if he didn't work. You know, and it's not like he's making a whole lot of money, you know, but he works like, I think, 5 hours a day, three to 4 days a week, depending on the week. But, you know, it's just.
Well, it's sometimes it feels to me like we want people just to, like, subsist and not be able to really get ahead.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
And why shouldn't they be able to have the same dreams and visions that the rest of us had about, you know, reaching for the next ring on the ladder?
Right.
You know,
exactly. You've boosted up your vocational program in the last year, this year?
Yes.
Last year, I guess, yeah. You started a thrift store, which I happen to know about. You know, but you can explain it.
You know. Well, we took over a thrift store that was in operation for many years locally.
Was it really?
Yes, the Lord's Closet.
Oh, okay.
The Lord's
All right.
Closet.
Yeah, okay.
Operated
right,
on
okay.
Route 22.
Yeah, it was on 22. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
White House, I
yep.
believe.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Right.
And
in the strip mall up there. Yeah.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And we took that over. We relocated to right here in Flemington.
Right.
Right on 31, everybody. Not far from the high school. And
right by Pete's Bike Shop.
Right by Pete's Bike Shop. Correct. And the
Pete, you owe me money. I gave you a plug there, you know.
Let me tell you, Pete's a very generous person, and I can talk later about how they aren't getting involved themselves. They've been extremely kind to us. But yes, our residents have an opportunity to real life, you know, we'll call it vocational experience, running a store. You know, we're talking about deliveries, pickups, working with inventory, working the cash register, dealing with customers that come in and out of the store. And if you think about those four or five little tasks I've just discussed, I mean, that might be 80, 90% of the jobs out there that are available. If you have some experience, you know, working the counter, doing inventory, et cetera, it's a great foundation. And, you know, one of the things that I am, you know, strong on, and we've talked about briefly, and as I mentioned, we're on an evolutionary path here, is talking about our residents and what about after high school? Because currently, there isn't anything we can kind of combination legally do and our resources are limited.
Right.
There are some instances that once they graduated high school, that is it from our end. And these young people, these young adults, are at their own, sometimes by themselves, to try to figure it out and find a place to live and a job, etc. So we believe this, our thrift store, is an opportunity for them to get some experience and build some real life skills.
I tell you, when we had the Clinton House, and I talked to Trish, the lady that I guess is like manager of it, and she sent the truck and two young men, but they were big guys, you know, made me look small, and they worked so hard filling that truck. I mean, you know, it was just awesome, you know, and so.
Well, and, you know, I think part of our vision really with it is, you know, we want the kids to have the initial experience with us, and then we hope that they move then to community employment. So one of the things that was happening at the time that we started the thrift store is our teenagers were really having a hard time finding local jobs in the community.
Oh, yeah.
And so if they have work experience through our thrift store, at least then they have a positive reference, and we can talk mm-hmm. to the employer about,
sure.
you know, this person shows up on time, they follow directives, those kinds of things. And, you know, I will say that in the last 6 months to a year, we have seen a significant increase in terms of our number of kids who are able to successfully get community employment now. As many as 60% of our kids at any point in time may have community employment. And then I think the other part of it, too, is, you know, some of our kids, like we talked about earlier, they're probably never going to get community employment because of a variety of issues that are going on
right.
in their own lives and developmentally where they are. So for them to be able to have something like the thrift store that is more normalizing and, you know, gives them a chance to earn income
sure.
and be able to go and do some of the things that the other kids can do, I think that's really beneficial to them as well.
Right.
And certainly the other thing for us as an organization is, you know, even though we've been around for, you know, 35, 40 years, we still think we're one of the best kept secrets around. And so we
yeah.
really hope
yeah.
that the thrift store will, you know, give us a different kind of exposure than what just our loan program does as well.
Right, right. And you, like most nonprofits, you know, you rely on fundraising and donations and, you know, to keep your doors open. So what are your quote-unquote strategies in this area? I know you got a golf thing coming up.
Yes, we do. Yes.
Okay,
now,
so.
Next Monday, May 9th, we're holding our second annual golf event at Stanton Ridge Golf Course in White House, New Jersey. We still have availability. We have limited availability. We still have some availability for golfers and sponsors. It's a great event. Real support from the community. There's a lot of local, and of course, Stanton Ridge has been very generous working with us. It starts in the morning with registration about 10:30, 11 o'clock. There's a lunch, a full day of golfing and refreshments, and a cocktail hour and dinner afterwards. We also have items that are going to be donated that people can bid on in an auction-style format. We had a great time last year. We had a lot of participants. We were very, very pleased with it, and we're looking forward to doing it again this year.
And if you don't golf, you can also come for the cocktail hour and dinner. So that's
there you go.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
a lot of fun. We have a lot of people on that end, too. Additionally, later in the year, in October, we have a comedy night. That's also been a few years running. It's been very, very, very successful.
Where do you hold it at?
That we've been holding at the Herndon Hills Playhouse.
Yeah, okay. Right.
On 173, technically, I guess, Lebanon.
Right. It's what it basically is, yeah.
Right. And that's a nice night out. It's basically a dinner out for you and, you know, for yourself or you and your spouse or loved ones or friends. It's a full dinner and cocktail hour. In addition to that, we generally have a few comics who provide an excellent show. In addition to that, there's items for bidding on different silent auction
right.
items ranging from trips and jewelry. And, you know, I bought one last year, which, you know, if you think about it this way, so I bought $1,000 off orthodontic work for one of my children. Now, you know, Lawrence and I were talking about this. I was going to spend the money anyway. You know, right. I had no choice. My daughter needed braces.
Right. Right.
But I ended up spending a few hundred dollars less than $1,000. So I gave money to a great organization supporting them, and I got a great deal mm-hmm. on dental work for my daughter, which she loves, or, you know, we like. So a lot of great things, great, you know, great way to get involved, a fun way to get involved, which is, I think if in life we're all looking to have fun in our lives.
Sure.
And if you can do that and help people at the same time, wow, what a win-win.
Right. I agree.
And I would like to add that, you know, like for myself especially, there's a lot of ways to get involved. And I have approached a few people in the last year, and one of the first things out of their mouth is, well, how much money do you want me to give? And my first response is zero. I don't want
– I'll train him better in the future.
Yes. Well, I'll talk to you about that too. But
the not point, much, just a little bit. You know?
Well, my approach has been with these other people that I've brought, you know, that I've talked to the organization, is that, look, your personal life experience is invaluable. There's no way for any of us to put a dollar amount on, you know, somebody's experience and or time, because that's one thing I think that's true about these organizations, specifically dealing with young people, is that their natural and biological systems broke down because they couldn't even provide time for their kids. Right. And these kids feel abandoned, and they are in many a sense emotionally, not just from a residential standpoint. And when we can bring in professionals, community people, anybody to show support and time for these kids, it makes them feel better. I see it on their faces. You know, when you just show an ounce of interest in their lives, they feel important.
Sure.
You know, and they feel better about themselves. So look, if you feel that, you know, for everybody listening out there, that some charity has their hand in your pocket, you know, of course, Lawrence, we will take donations. We're open to that. But we have committees that are in need of support. We just want people's time and experience to lend and make the organization better.
When you ask for volunteers, what would some of the things be that they'd be volunteering for?
Well, as I mentioned, I mean, we had a day of caring a few weeks ago where we had volunteers mainly from a local real estate firm come out and garden.
Okay.
That's all. They helped us garden. They cleaned up the yard a little bit. So that was just their time. They just spent a couple of hours doing something mm-hmm. they might have done at okay. their own home. Now, as I also mentioned, we have a few committees. We have a fundraising committee. We have a facilities committee, finance committee, where, you know, we're a relatively small organization. And, you know, again, if we had more people volunteering their time for these committees, it would help us grow as an organization. And also, again, you know, if two heads are good, three heads are better, whichever way you want to phrase that. But that's we were open to pretty much almost any involvement.
Well, sure. You know, and you know, as you can relate with the homes that your organization has run, there's always facility needs. And for us, I think that's one of the critical areas that we haven't completely filled the void yet. But I also want to mention that there are ways for people to work directly with the youth as well, either through tutoring. The gardening is a wonderful aspect because we do have some of our residents who really are interested in that, who enjoy some of the interactions with community members. And again, one of the things that I appreciate about it, and I think it's to Levin's point earlier, is, you know, yes, I think, you know, people feel like they're giving and it's very generous, but what you get back from doing
right.
it is very, very special as well. And, you know,
that's right.
For the most part, we have really just a wonderful group of boys to interact with. And, you know, I'll say 90% of the time, it's a real pleasure to interact with them.
Right.
I do want to mention one new fundraising opportunity that we have this year, which we're really excited about. And it actually is being sponsored by Pete's Bike Shop as well. So, so there's another plug for them. They have a racing group that has actually chosen us as their benefiting charity this year.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things that I can say as a small nonprofit is we're always so appreciative when other people take on the initiative of raising the money on your behalf because, as Levin said, limited resources, there's only so much we can do. But and this was really interesting to me because I didn't even know such things existed. But I guess within a 24-hour period, they try to do, is it 200 miles, Levin?
It's 360 kilometers. which is over 200 miles.
So overnight, even, you know, within that 24 hours, you're supposed to do this distance. So it really is
an individual is supposed to do that distance or as a group?
An individual, I think. And the way they do it, as I understand it, and Levent may correct me here, but, you know, you do it as a group, I think, because they don't want you necessarily to do it on your own, but do it with the group.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be small groups, and it doesn't have to be on a specific course. So you can do it in Atlantic City. You can do it here in Flemington. You can do it in Northern Jersey. You can do it in California. You can do it wherever. And the registration fees for from participating come to our organization this year. So we're really, really excited about that opportunity.
Yeah.
Not that we're
that seems like
personally
awful,
participate.
That seems like a large distance to do.
It does. Yeah. I have some friends who I've talked to about it, and one of their immediate responses is, well, you know, you're not doing it, Levent, because I know you don't cycle. And you have to be a serious cyclist to even approach this. So. But they were very familiar with it, and a couple of my friends are going to support it. It's if you can just Google New Jersey Arrow, I believe that's the you can get more information on that.
Right.
Yeah, or Pete's Bike Shop.
A lot of the bicycling things are like new or coming about because a young lady from the church I go to is a police officer in Long Valley, and they have a group of policemen, men, women, police officers, who bicycled down to Washington, D.C., where there's a monument now being erected or is erected for law enforcement who have gave their lives over the course of time and stuff. And it's just, you know, and she was, you know, put a thing on the website about raising funds for it, you know. And, you know, it's just... You see more and more of bicycling, you know, and I just, you know.
Well, let's face it. I think it's great that people are really, I think, starting to take an interest in taking care of their health in different ways than we thought about 30 years ago.
Yep, that's true.
And I think that's one key piece of it. And didn't New York just have their five-borough race?
Yeah, they did. Right.
You see all
Sunday,
those people who are
Sunday.
Out there doing that.
Yesterday, actually.
In the rain. It's amazing.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. We have about 5.5 minutes left. When summer hits, what do your clients do or not do or where, you know, what happens?
Well, so, you know, summer is coming up and, you know, for a lot of our kids, almost all of our kids who come to us are academically behind.
Okay.
And so one of the things we really try to do over the summer is – whenever possible is to get them engaged in formal summer school so that hopefully they can earn some of the credits to catch up on some of the things they're behind in. Not all of our kids are eligible for that, but those that are, we really try to make that happen because, you know, it is so critical. And education is something that all of us in the program continue to stress to our youth. For those who aren't able to participate in that, one of the things that we try to also do is it's the great time to try out some family reunification efforts. So we try to send the boys home with their families for a long weekend, for a week, to sort of see how are the tools that they're learning in the program translating at home. And it's sort of a testing ground for how close are they to really being ready to go home. But then for the kids who are completely in our program, we try to do a combination of formal programming and also give them a little bit of a summer break because one of the things that we think is important is, you know, it's pretty normal for kids to go back to school in the fall and talk about, here's the fun, exciting trip we did over the summer. So for our kids, it tends to be like a Dorney Park kind of thing. The board has done some initiatives with like professional sports, whether it's hockey or baseball or football, so that the kids have some of those kinds of things that they can talk about as well. But then it also gives us a chance to really partner with some of our community organizations and have them come in and talk about, we may have the credit union, financial resources credit union that comes in and talks quite a bit with our kids about financial literacy and financial planning. So they'll do a couple of days on that. Safet Hunterton comes in and talks about domestic violence. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, so many of our kids have been exposed to extremes of abuse. So how do you cope with that? But also, how do you prevent it from replicating in your own life in the future?
Right.
We tend to have Planned Parenthood come in and talk about sexual health and sexual health education and those kinds of things. Because with teenage boys, that is certainly an area of great interest. So those would be some of the the kinds of ways that we really.
If someone needed to reach out to you, how would they get a hold of you?
So certainly you can do it through our website, which is huntertonyouthservices.org. That's huntertonyouthservices.org. Or you can call the office at 908-782-0848, 908-782-0848.
All right. I think that I can't tell you how happy I am that you guys were here today. And I really mean that you're going to have to come back. You know,
that's always a pleasure, Larry. Thanks for having
because
us.
Because it just seems like, you know, you get the it's a way of getting the word out, you know. And who knows, you may not get anybody calling or whatever, but it may just plant something in somebody's head down the road. And that's is important also, you know.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that I think we feel so appreciative about is, you know, you do realize, and I'm sure you realize it with your organization as well, That handful of people who really engage and get involved, what a difference they make.
Right, exactly.
In the lives of those we're serving.
Sure.
It's amazing.
Absolutely. And one more time, the phone number?
The phone number is 908-782-0848.
And the website?
HuntertonYouthServices.org.
Okay. And I really appreciate it, guys. I really do. And like I said,
thank you, Larry.
You know, and I have to get a hold of Trish when I come back.
We appreciate that, too.
Yes, we do. But, you know, it's just something that, you know, if you guys can sell the furniture and get some funds, that's fine, you know, because some of it is in real good condition and some needs to be redone. But, you know, she said she'd want it all. So you've been listening to Mental Health Matters, and we're going to be here next week. Same time, same station. And remember, folks, mental health really does matter. We'll see you next week. Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
USA Radio News with Audrey Strong.
Donald Trump is holding a commanding lead in Indiana. An NBC News Wall Street Journal poll has the billionaire real estate mogul leading with 49% support. Texas Senator Ted Cruz is next with 34%. Ohio Governor John Kasich trails with 13%.
I'm different because I'm going to win states that nobody else can. And when I can focus on Hillary, she'll go down easier than any of the people we just beat.
There are 57 delegates up for grabs Tuesday in the Indiana GOP primary. Trump currently has 987 delegates and needs 1,237 to secure the nomination. The race is much closer on the Democratic side, with frontrunner Hillary Clinton leading Bernie Sanders by a 50-46% margin in Indiana. This is USA Radio News.
Hey, it's Rusty Humphreys, host of Trending Today USA, where we feature the biggest and the best and the brightest trending stories in the world. One of the places I go first every single day is WesternJournalism.com. Chris Agee's here. He's the managing editor of WesternJournalism.com. What makes WesternJournalism.com so special?